You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
It's Sam Cedar, launching an illegal invasion and occupation of your brain.
This episode of The Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook of your choice. Go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. That's audiblepodcast.com/majority report for a free audiobook.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Monday, December 3rd, 2012. It is not casual Friday. It is very button-down Monday. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live, not in the literal nor metaphorical shadow of the New York Times building, in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City, but instead I am on the road. I am en route to former hometown, I guess, Worcester, Massachusetts, to give a talk. But today on the program, Sarah Jaffe on the movement to organize workers at fast food restaurants in New York City and perhaps around the country, its implications for a change in the union movement. And also on the program today, a special look back on my attack on a plutocrat this weekend. Sort of breaking, I don't know, breaking format, but what the heck. I can do whatever I want. Also on the program, Romney's sad. Taxes are low. I don't know if I ever got to that Romney tattoo guy story either. And, of course, a brief update on the state of play with the grand bargain. All that and more on today's program. All right, folks, just settling in here, if you can bear with me. Okay, so we're going to start off, before we get to Sarah Jaffe or this, over the weekend, I was on up with Chris, the Chris Hayes program, obviously one of my favorite programs on television, also one of my favorite ones to be on. I generally don't go over and spend time talking about my television appearances. I know that's contrary to the what you're supposed to do in talk radio. But, once or twice a week I go on, I don't know, CNBC or Current or MSNBC, whatever it is. And for the most part, they're rather uneventful. The appearance that I made on Up with Chris this weekend was a lot of fun, and it stuck with me, and I wanted to talk to you about it. It was rather interesting, I thought. But before we get there, first off, this very, very sad story about Mitt Romney, who apparently is having a tough go of it, folks. You got to feel a little sad. From the Washington Post, The man who planned to be president wakes up each morning now without a plan. Gone are the minute-by-minute schedules and the swarm of Secret Service agents. There's no aide at his side to make his peanut butter and honey sandwiches. Wait a second. To make his honey and peanut... Well, the guy's a multimillionaire. He's got to fob off the job of making his peanut butter and honey sandwiches to his campaign. I thought this guy was a job creator. He's a millionaire. Multimillionaire. The guy makes $20 million a year. He's putting an elevator in his house for his car. Seems to me he should be able to get a guy to make his peanut butter and honey sandwiches. Instead of having to embezzle that money from his campaign to get his peanut butter and jelly sandwiches or honey sandwiches made. Anyways. Romney hangs around the house, sometimes alone, pecking away at his iPad and emailing his CEO buddies, who have been swooping in and out of La Jolla to visit. He wrote to one who's having a liver transplant soon. I'll change your bedpan, take you back and forth to treatment. Now, of course, he didn't really mean that. That was supposed to be a joke. I wouldn't do that. No, you should hire someone to do that. But, I mean, as a joke, I've got nothing to do, so let me make this about me instead of your liver. Romney's rapid retreat into seclusion has been marked by repressed emotions, second-guessing, and perhaps for the first time in the overachiever's adult life, sustained boredom, according to interviews with more than a dozen of Romney's closest friends and advisors. He's an overachiever? Yeah, maybe, I guess. I don't know. Compared to who? His dad? His dad headed a major U.S. car company. His dad fought off bigots and marched with civil rights advocates. Dad was the governor of Michigan, and I think had far greater popularity than Mitt Romney does in Massachusetts. Let's continue. After Romney told his wealthy donors that he blamed the loss on gifts Obama gave to minority groups, he sort of went quiet. One longtime counselor contrasted Romney with former President Al Gore, whose weight gain and beard became a symbol of grievance over his 2000 loss. You won't see heavy-set, haggard Mitt. Oh, in other words, he took his loss really well, except for that part about blaming poor people. In fact, John Miller says, a meatpacking magnat who co-chaired Romney's finance committee and owns the beach house next door, he's not crying on anybody's shoulders. He's not blaming anybody, except, of course, those poor people who are getting gifts. By all accounts, the past month has been most difficult on Romney's wife, Ann, whose friends say believed up until the end that ascending to the White House was their destiny. They said she's been crying in private and trying to get back to riding her horses. You know, you never know if these things are true, and I don't want to mock, Mitt Romney's wife, but the sense of entitlement is pretty stunning. Romney has ruled out running for another office, advisor Eric Fernstein said, of course, because he could not win one. In private, Romney has told friends he has little interest in helping the Republican Party rebuild and rebrand itself. Of course he does. Because the guy never believed in anything but his own ambition anyways. So why should he? Advisors also said he felt no need to explain himself after his comments to donors about Obama using the power of the incumbency to give gifts to female, black, and Latino voters. Of course he doesn't. Of course he doesn't have to explain himself to anybody. I frankly don't even care. Romney relied heavily on like-minded millionaires to raise more than $1 billion during the campaign, and he's been calling many of them to thank them individually for their help. Last week, he called JetBlue Airways chairman Joel Peterson, an old friend. So far, however, Romney hasn't called up some of his supporters who contributed in other ways. For years, he competed for the affections of GOP activists in Iowa. Romney called Joni Scotter over and over again on her birthdays, on her 50th anniversary wedding. When Scotter's husband died this spring, Romney had white roses and lilies delivered to her. Scotter says he hasn't heard, she hasn't heard from Romney since he lost Iowa on November 6th. Well, surprise, surprise. Turns out he just liked the millionaire buddies, not those other people who were helping him. Friends said Romney plans to reside mostly in La Jolla during the colder months and in Wolfboro, New Hampshire, where he has a lakefront compound during the warmer months, but he'll maintain his official residency in Massachusetts. God knows what tax schemes are dependent on him maintaining that residence in Massachusetts. Well, Mitt Romney, it was nice knowing you. I'm glad we shan't know you again. And now, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Sarah Jaffe about these strikes in New York City. And then I will walk you through my adventure with a plutocrat on Up With Chris this past weekend. Back in a sec.
This episode of The Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Why not pick up Eric Schlosser's Fast Food Nation? It's an Audible book and you can get it for free. audiblepodcast.com/majority report. Go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. Get a free Audible book. You can get Eric Schlosser's Fast Food Nation for free. You can do it now.
Okay, we are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Sarah Jaffe. She is an independent journalist, a contributor to The Atlantic. She wrote a piece for The Atlantic on this these wildcat strikes that took place in New York City last week at fast food restaurants. Welcome to the program, Sarah.
So, I mean, wildcat strikes isn't exactly right. They were planned in advance and very well coordinated, but they are a different kind of strike than we're used to seeing these days.
All right. Well, then let's be explicit about this. So we had how many people went on strike where were they striking last week?
So over 200 workers at 24 different fast food franchises went on strike last week in New York. That means they were at McDonald's, Wendy's, Burger King, KFC, Taco Bell, and I believe Domino's Pizza. Workers went on strike at locations around the city. So it was across the industry, and it's across different franchises, different companies. all across the city, but they were all coordinated together. They're trying to form an independent union for fast food workers in New York. It would be the Fast Food Workers Committee.
And so how long have these plans for the strikes been planned?
They've been in the works for months and months now. There have been about 40 organizers, mostly with a group called New York Communities for Change, doing organizing on the ground with these workers at different stores. And it's a really tough organizing job for many reasons, one of them being that low-wage workers don't make a lot of money to keep cell phones on and, you know, permanent addresses. So just that bit of struggle alone has been really hard. But it's also been, you know, these are jobs with a lot of turnover. You'll have a great worker, great leader that then leaves. And so it's been really, this is the first time that there's been anything like this in the fast food industry in this country, any sort of sustained organizing campaign like this with this kind of success.
And that seems to be the tie-in. I mean, I know there's no direct tie-in, although maybe there is some in your reporting. You've come across some relationship to what was happening with the Walmart strikes. But this is one of the biggest challenges, I think, to the union movement in that you have, unlike where, let's say, factories and industry towns, where you have literally a physical congregation of workers to unionize. I mean, if you walk into a factory, there's 1,600 people working there who potentially could benefit from a union. That is a very effective. That makes your organizing that much more effective. But this is, I mean, taken with the Walmart at least organizing, does this signal a change in the way that unions are perceiving what their job is and how to approach it?
I mean, when you look at Walmart, you see a company that unions had tried to organize for a long time, right? Walmart's been around for 50 years. Unions have known that they need to break Walmart, especially as it just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger, right? It has this huge presence in retail. It sets the wages, and by sets them, we mean drives them down for workers around the country. Unions have known they needed to break Walmart. They haven't been able to, and what's been going on with our Walmart and its success has been largely because they've adapted to that and learned from the workers what kind of things would help them. The fast food workers, this has largely been an industry that's been just left alone. It's been considered too low wage. It's been considered a job for teenagers. It's a high turnover workplace. And because of this franchise issue, right, because McDonald's doesn't control every single store that has the McDonald's name on it. They sell them to franchisees, and they dictate a whole list of rules for the workers at those places. But as, you know, several people noted, I spoke to Stephen Lerner for my story, they don't dictate how workers have to be treated. If McDonald's or Burger King or Wendy's wanted to say, you have to pay your workers a minimum of $15 an hour and they have to get paid sick days, they could also write that into the franchise contracts, the way they write in, you know, the food that they have to sell and the amount that they have to kick back to the company. So they don't do that, and that's, you know, that's one issue. But organizing the workers in the independent stores, they're targeting different bosses in each place, are not all targeting the McDonald's corporation. So there's multiple layers of why this is really complicated work to do. And so this has been, it took a community group to do it and to see it as community organizing.
That brings up two questions. One, do you think that strategically, and I imagine that the organizers have that mapped this stuff out. I mean, obviously you start in New York in many respects because, again, you're talking about a higher concentration of people. You're also, to the extent that there is any parity, I mean, look, you can't get much lower than the wages for a lot of these people, regardless of where you are nationally, because we have a federal minimum wage. So when you're talking about $7.25 per hour in New York, which is what most of, I guess the median is somewhere around $8.30 or something for these employees.
I think it's like $8.70 nationwide, but I did not talk to a single fast food worker in leading up to the strike, and when I was out last Thursday on the picket lines with them, I did not talk to a single worker who made over $8 an hour.
Now, people have to understand that if you're living in New York City and you buy a Metro card to get to work, which I would say the percentage of these workers who are probably having to commute into the city, because I, you know, nobody can afford to live in Manhattan, right, is rather high. So you're talking about, you know, $200 a month for a Metro card. And at $7.25, even $8, you know, 40 hours a week, you know, you're talking about $1,200 a month. 200 of that is eaten up. You know, I'm talking before taxes, is eaten up by just getting to work. Never mind the hour each way that you're probably spending on that train. So we're now, is the strategy to A, try and get concessions and raise the rates of wages of people in New York, and then take this nationally on the franchisee level or the franchisor level? In other words, once they've been able to, assuming they can organize New York and get a union going in New York, do you then start to go to other major cities around the country, or do you go directly to McDonald's nationally and Burger King and whatnot and say, you've got to write this into your franchise agreements?
I mean, that would be really great. I think what happened here was that, like I said, this started with a community group that is based here in New York, that they were actually doing housing organizing, and they were talking to workers in fast food restaurants about housing issues and finding that, you know, people can't pay for housing when they're making $7.25 an hour. And that led to this kind of organizing in the fast food restaurants. They've also been organizing low-wage workers in car washes, in grocery stores. So they've been working with low-wage workers across the city, and that's been where this effort came out of. Now, that said, I'm hearing that there are other fast food organizing efforts in, like, Chicago, in other places, where they're working on this a similar kind of approach. And it would be great if this went to McDonald's corporate headquarters. But I think the thing that you're seeing with these kind of one-day strikes and these kind of tactics is that it's less of a, like, we're going to go out on strike until we get what we want, and much more like, we're going to keep disrupting business until things change. And it's much more, it's looser, it's more flexible, it builds in momentum, rather than sort of going out on strike and, like, the first week you're really excited and the second week you're getting tired and on the third week you haven't been able to buy groceries because you haven't been working and, oh my God. It can build, and people can come in and out. People can walk out on strike. When I was standing outside of a Wendy's in Brooklyn, one worker who had not originally planned to go out on strike walked out and joined the picket line. You know, it allows for things like that. And it's just going to keep escalating until things get better. And we, you know, hopefully it continues to roll. So even if the workers get their union recognition, then they're organized. Then they can push for paid vacation. Then they can push for sick days. Then they can push for regular cost of living raises or other, you know, issues. That's the benefit of having the union, is that you're then already organized and you already have a mechanism for, you know, asking for more.
Has anybody done any, is there any data on whether or not these jobs are continue to be as they've been perceived to be? And maybe they never were, but at least the perception was that these were transitional jobs, that you,
right,
you either got this job after you got out of high school or out of college, or it was something to do for the summer, or that to the extent that somebody was working there, it was simply a stopgap measure. Do we have any knowledge as to whether or not basically that the percentage of people who enter into this industry, and I'm talking specifically the fast food industry, end up staying there for longer than in the past?
You know, I don't know the data for turnover. I know that these tend to be high turnover jobs because, in essence, that's one of the reasons that, you know, they're so hard to organize, right? Is that if you, you know, if your manager doesn't like you, he can fire you for any reason whatsoever. And this is true of basically any job in this country where you don't have a written contract, either through a union or because you are, you know, somebody who they negotiate contracts with. And so there's always more people, right? Right now we still have high unemployment. We've seen manufacturing jobs disappear over the last 30 years or so. And so these have become the jobs that fill in those gaps, right? So now instead of it being high school kids, the median age for fast food workers is 28. And not only that, but this is an fast food workers are two-thirds women, and the median age for women in this industry is 32. I mean, these are adult people. These are, you know, these are not kids getting a job after high school or during high school. These are people who are trying to feed their family on minimum wage, and it's ridiculous.
And we should also say, too, that the people have to understand that we are subsidizing. This is the same situation with Walmart. I mean, so in the event that we are talking about wages going up, and even if that causes a nominal increase in the cost of a hamburger, let's say, maybe it goes up. I mean, I would imagine it's less. We're talking about less than 5 cents a hamburger. If you were to pay everybody a living wage there, it's probably lower. But let's assume it is. At the very least, we are beginning to pass on the costs that these companies have managed to basically submerge and hide that everyone is paying. So in other words, we are paying to support their workers, whether it is with Medicaid, whether it's with food stamps, whether it is with any other series of programs so that these people can survive. Meanwhile, we're subsidizing McDonald's to do so. And this is a way of sort of exposing those costs for what they really are.
Right. I mean, yeah, exactly. We're subsidizing McDonald's ability to have a dollar value menu. And that dollar value menu is, you know, that's not what those things actually cost, right? Because the work wages aren't being held down. And, right, we're essentially paying for cheap fast food, whether we eat cheap fast food or not. I mean, I know the health conscious people and you know, a lot of good liberals would say, I would never eat a McDonald's anyway. That stuff's terrible. But, like, well, we're paying for it anyway. we're paying for it through the tax code because we're paying for food stamps. We're paying for Medicaid. We're paying for all these programs that people need. And people who are working a job that is ostensibly a full-time job, although they can never actually get their hours steady or enough of them, we're paying for it. And I don't have a problem with paying for people to have health care. I don't have a problem with my tax dollars going to food stamps. I think that's actually the best use of my tax dollars that I can think of. But we're paying for McDonald's executives to get stupid rich, right? Because, you know, the highest paid executive at McDonald's made like something like $6 or $8, $10 million last year. The highest paid executive at Yum Brands, which owns Taco Bell and KFC, made $20 million last year.
Most of that $20 million gets eaten up between taking Subway, getting a Subway tokens and taxes. But the point is also, I would take it a step further too, that not only do I not mind subsidizing people who need help in this situation and other, frankly, other government programs, but the bottom line is I trust the government to do it better rather than, yes, the like you're saying, the inefficiency involved in my subsidizing the McDonald's CEO's lavish lifestyle. So give me a sense of what happens next here. I mean, obviously it's very unpredictable and there's a lot going on here, but what do you anticipate happening next?
Right. I mean, the great thing about this, right, is that it is sort of rolling, and it's, somebody used the term viral strikes in relation to the Walmart strikes, which I think is exactly what's going on here. Right. There's going to be a rally this Thursday in New York, and it's going to be the fast food workers along with a bunch of other low-wage workers who've been organizing. And, I mean, I think what we're seeing is the beginnings of a movement of low-wage workers, right? You're seeing Walmart, you're seeing fast food, you're seeing car wash workers, you're seeing people across the country saying, hey, I've been demonized by politicians who talk about food stamps and talk about all this stuff, and I work my butt off, and I deserve some recognition, and we deserve some better pay. There's no reason that these jobs have to be low-paying jobs, just like there was no reason that working on an assembly line at Ford had to be a low-paying job, right? The CIO, the Congress of Industrial Union Organizations, was built out of these low-skill, very you know, they were very low-paying jobs, and they were deliberately broken down on the assembly line so that, you know, one person just did one task over and over all day long. They were miserable. terrible jobs. They were terrible. They became those good middle-class jobs that politicians love to talk about because the workers organized. And if we can, if this stuff starts to work, we have, you know, this is a whole other generation that, that'll change the life of millions of people.
Well, we'll continue to follow this story. I should also correct myself. I think I said $200 for a Metro card over the course of a month. It's closer to about $105. But
105 now, but they want to raise it to 125. So.
Right. I mean, that's, and you're, that's a huge chunk of someone's pay. If you're making $7.25, $8 an hour, and maybe getting 35 hours a week at one of these restaurants. Sarah, right. I appreciate you coming on and walking us through this thing, and we'll continue to watch for your reporting on this.
Great. Thanks a lot.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I'm going to walk you through with sound clips of this exchange that I had on Chris Hayes' program this weekend with a just a massive plutocrat. It was it really got under my skin. I think that's why I was brought on, frankly, to the program. And then a little bit later in the program, we'll be taking your phone call, 646-257-3920. The IM machine is working today. Majority FM or any of my IM handles that you may have, legacy handles, and, of course, Majority FM at Jabber.org. We'll be right back in just a moment. And, again, if you can become a member of the Majority Report, please do. It's not the only way to support the program, but it is the most efficient way of supporting the program. You can also, of course, if you buy junk through Amazon, buy it through our link at majority.fm, support the show. You can just look at the top of the website. It says support the show. Click it. You can see other ways of supporting the show, including buying your coffee through justcoffee.coop, fair trade, coffee, tea, chocolate, organic. If you want it, the coffee's great. The company's fantastic. Couldn't be a better situation for everybody involved. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a minute. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. That is arguably my one of my maybe my favorite band ever. I don't know. It's pretty close. I can't. It's Buffalo Tom, but I can't. I don't know. Maybe it's one of my top five. Let's put it that way. Sunflower Suit. All right. So now what we're going to do is I'm going to walk you through. This weekend, I was on Up with Chris, and as many of you know, on occasion, I have filled in for Chris Hayes. I've had him on this program many times. This version of the Majority Report, he claims that the first time he ever did media was on the old Majority Report. Maybe the case, I don't know. The point being is that I know that when I am brought on that program, often they are there's a reason. You know, being a bit of a generalist, I'm not bringing some of the expertise that some of the other guests do on that show. I am bringing the ability to talk, but they find people who can talk. And in this instance, all I was told was coming on to talk about the grand bargain and the role that so-called entitlements, social insurance programs are playing in the context of the grand bargain. And when I got there, I found out that one of the guests, and I was doing like the middle segment, 8:30 or something after the filibuster reform segment, which was actually fascinating. And so the original guest who was supposed to be on with us as well, I can't remember who it was a an expert on these programs, an economist. And so but they had laryngitis. They couldn't show up, whatever it was. So I was on with Richard Arenberg, who was the author of Defending the Filibuster, who had been in the segment prior, Victoria DeFrancesco Soto, who's an MSNBC contributor, and I think she's a senior analyst at Latino Decisions and a fellow at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. And this other guy, Don Peebles, who is the chairman and CEO of the Peebles Corporation and a member of President Obama's National Finance Committee. Now, the Finance Committee is basically, I can't remember what the Bush pioneers or basically the guy in charge of helping raise money and then sticks around to advise on issues of money. I didn't really think much. I didn't know if there was going to be an argument about any of these. I had no idea. It didn't even occur to me. I was really very focused on making sure that I ate a piece of pastry on camera, because that apparently is a there's a massive Up with Chris subculture that is focused on that. And I also I have a propensity when I see free pastry to eat it. I can't help it. So the we started off with Chris going through the state of the negotiations, and this is And at one point, I explained that what was really interesting in terms of what was happening is that the Republicans, their bluff has basically been called. The Democrats said, if you want to cut so-called entitlements, just tell us what it is. And the Republicans came back with, well, no, you have to tell us what you propose to cut out of Medicare and Social Security. And this is the game that the Republicans have played in the past. They get the Democrats to make a cut, and then the Republicans have run against them on that cut. And then they went to Peebles talking about President Obama's new grand bargain position. DeFrancesca Soto talks about getting into more cuts and how people supposedly have been pulling off from Norquist. And then this is what happens. Peebles sort of pivots, and it occurred to me at one point, probably during the break after the segment, that's why he's here. Not just to pontificate on it, but he literally, this is his agenda. This is clip number one.
Programs, obviously, and the Republicans don't.
Okay, we'll start that over again. So here is Don or Donahue Peebles talking about what's next in the grand bargain.
Well, I don't think anybody wants to cut programs, obviously, and the Republicans don't, because they're now in what they consider the rebuilding mode. But, you know, the challenge is going to be that there are Democrats. Like, if you take a look at some of these tax issues, for example, estate taxes, the president is not going to have unified support from the House on that issue, because he's going to lose, most likely, the Congressional Black Caucus. He's going to lose representatives of farming states, because it's going to decimate
Okay,
now wait a second. Let me explain what just happened here. So Peebles, after talking about all this stuff, the completely, mostly non-controversial in any way, then just sort of raises the fact that where he thinks there's going to be a problem for the president is in the estate tax. He's going to lose the Congressional Black Caucus, and we'll get to that in a minute, and he's going to lose senators from farm states, because the estate tax could devastate farmers. Now, Hayes immediately says that's a bunch of crap. And it's because that anybody who spent any time looking at this knows that there were 100 families across the country who own farms who are subject to the estate tax. It's not even remote. There will be 300 families across the country who would be subject, who own farms, who would be subject to the estate tax. Under President George W. Bush, the estate tax dropped to 35% after a $5 million exemption for an individual to pass on to his kids. So an individual can pass on $5 million worth of assets, and then whatever they pass on beyond that gets taxed at a 35% rate after that. President Obama wants to raise this rate to 45% after a $3.5 million exemption. Before George Bush, it was 55% after a $1 million exemption. So President Obama is taking us back to a rate that still is below the pre-George Bush tax rates. And there are some Democrats, guys like Max Baucus in the Senate, a couple other Democrats in the Senate, McCaskill, maybe Tester, maybe Pryor of Arkansas. Now, Arkansas, we know why. That's where the Walton family is. I mean, we're literally talking about a tax that applies to a certain amount of, like a handful of families in this country. And this guy's bringing up the Congressional Black Caucus. Of the 3,600 estates subject to the estate tax this year in the country, 3,600. 100 are classified as farming estates. The number of estates subject to the tax would double under the plan proposed by Obama. So we're talking about an infinitesimally small group of people here. And this guy is out there defending it for some reason.
Let's think about it this way. Let's look at it from African Americans' perspective. Hundreds of years of oppression. Finally, there's an opportunity to go and compete in a balanced way in this economy today. But there's a head start. And so of generational transferring of wealth. And so finally now, with equality that's taken place since the Civil Rights Movement, you have a more alignment of wealth.
Do you see what's happening here? The guy is using the Civil Rights Movement as some type of fig leaf for why millionaires should retain as much wealth as possible. And I immediately go into like a complete... I'm almost jumping out of my chair at this point. Now, I should say I didn't know who this guy was, this guy Peebles. But it turns out that I've since done a little bit of research. It turns out that Donahue Peebles was named, and God bless him, congratulations, one of the top 10 wealthiest African Americans in the country by Forbes magazine. I have it here somewhere, but it turns out this guy has a net worth of millions upon millions of dollars. Millions upon millions of dollars here. Here it is. $350 million as of May 2009, according to Forbes. So when this guy's talking about we need to allow African-American success stories to pass on their wealth dollar for dollar to their kids to catch up to the white people who've been doing it for a long time. But we are still, even when we talk about white people, talking about an infinitesimally small number of people. And in terms of black millionaires, we're also talking about an infinitesimally small number of people. However, one of them apparently was sitting to my left in between me and the Danish on Up With Chris, and he was worth at least $350 million.
off, and now it's going to be wiped out by 55%.
Such an infinitesimally small number of people. I mean, literally, we could fit all of the people you're talking about probably in this room.
You're talking about African Americans in the United States who are subject to the estate tax. I'm not arguing the actual merits
of the issue. I'm telling you the politics of it. The Congressional Black Caucus voted with George Bush
the last time around on estate taxes, and they are going to talk about the politics.
So now you see what he's done. He has now pivoted from making the argument that we should repeal the estate tax to now just being a commentator who's saying these are the politics. I'm not arguing the merits of the policy now. He's made this shift. He's immediately just ducked my assertion about the estate tax. And now he's just talking about the politics. Now, it is true, the Congressional Black Caucus, there were 8 defectors back during George Bush's administration that voted with him on the estate tax. I think half of whom are gone. One was Sheila Jackson Lee from Texas, sort of a surprise, but we're talking about the money they get from millionaires. Al Wynn, I think, from Maryland, who's gone. Jefferson from Louisiana, gone because he had money in his refrigerator or freezer or whatever it was. Bishop from Georgia, Scott from Georgia, obviously the same millionaire donor down there. I mean, so we're talking about, he's making this as if this is a big civil rights issue. You had 8 defectors from the Congressional Black Caucus who just got bought out.
Well, I don't think anybody wants to cut.
All right, so I go on and basically make that argument with Don Peebles. And then during the break, I basically tell him that what he's talking about is a complete fig leaf. I don't realize at this point that I'm standing next to the number 10 in 2009 wealthiest black Americans in the country. I don't know that he's got $350 million worth of assets. I don't realize that I have not just said that the only reason why the politics are happening here are because of money, but I don't realize that I'm actually saying, like, no, the only reason why there's the Congressional Black Caucus or anybody else doing this is probably because of your money or your buddy's money. And he's using this as if this is a civil rights issue. It's just absurd. And he keeps talking about political reality now into the break. So I am steaming mad because this guy is, he sees me as some type of, I don't know, hippie. And he's during the break, he's going like, what about your dad? I mean, how did you, and I said, well, my dad's an attorney. His dad was an attorney. They haven't been subject to the estate tax rule. But even if they were, great. The argument is that he is trying to make during the break that I'm doing this from white privilege. Now, this is a guy whose father was a mechanic, Peebles, worked his way up, got into real estate. God bless. I'm excited he has $350 million. I hope he has $500 million by now. Maybe he has $700 million. It doesn't matter to me. And I'm happy that his kids are going to get $5 million. And then after that, let's say he has $500 million to give to them. They get $5 million, and then they get taxed at a 35% rate on the $495 million. And so they'll end up with another $250 million to spill between the two of them. I don't feel bad for them. So then we come back in after the break. I'm telling him that this is a fig leaf. Hayes comes back. He turns to the talk of cutting Medicare. And here it is.
The big problem is the rate of growth of healthcare costs. I think we could all agree on that, right?
Yep.
Now, Medicare, the rate of growth in Medicare is significantly lower than the rate of growth of healthcare costs in the private sector. So it's doing a better job of controlling costs relative to the private sector. Then we just passed a huge bill that was incredibly contentious, which is called the Affordable Care Act, the vast majority of the legislative language of which is about controlling costs in healthcare over the future. And so it seems to me like the reasonable thing to do is to wait 4 years, 5 years, implement the bill, and see if the cost control measures that have been put in place, thought about tooth and nail, not like you know, smuggled in the cover of night, like hugely, hugely controversial, whether those cost containment methods work. And then, you know, we can all sit at this table 5 years from now, and I don't understand why this isn't just the opening position of Democrats, and as someone who's on the Hill, shouldn't that be the opening position?
Well, yes.
Thank you. Well said.
So I included that clip where Arenberg at the end agrees, and this guy is sitting next to me, and he's basically agreeing with most of what I've said. I mean, I have no idea who he is. And Hayes has laid it out now, because apparently, I mean, they obviously knew who Peebles was and what he had been advocating. And I should say at this point that in my study of who this guy Peebles is, not only did I find that he was worth at least $300-400 million, apparently he was one of these guys who over the summer told HuffPo that he was mad with President Obama for attacking hedge funders and private equity guys. I look and see at those things that are becoming offensive to some of his strongest supporters financially. It would be unrealistic to think that that kind of thing would not impact the enthusiasm for those who are supportive of the president financially, and certainly would turn off others who were on the fence to say, you know what? What the heck with it? I'm done. And they go on to Romney. So this is Donahue Peebles, who has raised at least between $100,000 and $200,000 for President Obama, saying, it's not me, but there are other people out there. This is the way this guy works it, right? It's always other people who are advocating for certain things. Not him, of course. He says there are other people out there. Now, my support for President Obama is very strong, but there are other people out there who are pretty pissed. He goes on to say, I'm so tired of hearing that the rich are not paying their fair share of taxes. Yeah, we are. The super vast majority of wealthy Americans do not wake up every day and say, let's see how we can pay less than our fair share of taxes. Of course they don't. They look up and say, what a beautiful view I have. Or, man, do I feel great. That's a wonderful $15,000 mattress I slept on. They say, we're going to follow the law and we're going to hire some good accountants to tell us how to do it. And we're going to pay no more, no less than our fair share. What? This is the way this guy's defending paying these lowest tax rates on $350 million since the 1940s? Is, hey, I wake up every morning and I just think I'm going to hire the best accountant I can. So I'm paying not a dime more than I'm legally responsible for. So what should be said is that the wealthy Americans should have their tax rates raised because we need more money. Now, by the way, if they got all these tax raises, it still wouldn't put a dent in the national debt. So that's who this Peebles guy is. And here is where I start to stick a finger in his eye, because I'm pissed. I'm realizing what this guy is about, and it's really pissing me off, and now I'm trying to agitate him a little bit.
Has been
he
some
has
of the
done,
precedent
has
in
done
the
in the early, yeah.
Getting back to your original question, I think, frankly, it has to do with the same thing as to why we're debating maintaining historically low estate taxes. It's money. Right. There is absolutely no reason in terms of the budget to be even talking about Social Security. And in terms of Medicare, it's the exact same thing. I'm sure there are cuts that can be made in terms of efficiencies, particularly when it comes to pharmaceuticals. There's a lot of savings there. I mean, you have...
Right. Then Hayes asked me to describe those, and I talk about where we could have the government be able to get a volume discount for the drugs that it's paying, and we could also get rid of patent... some type of patent reform, we would save $300 billion at least over the course of 10 years. So I've stuck my finger in his eye, and then we come back for the third segment, and this is where I make an argument about means testing. And people and I start going after it.
Really interesting. I want to show some polling, because I think one of the weirdest dynamics is this
And this is Hayes talking about the state of play in the argument that we're seeing in Washington. And I had this conversation with Francesca DeSoto during the break, where I was like, there's nothing less popular than cutting Medicare or Social Security. It's only rich people in Washington who want to do it. And she just looked at me like, what? It's unbelievable. And so here's Hayes basically drawing out that point.
Match between where public opinion is on something, on what we call on the show social insurance, and where the kind of beltway conversation is about the quote entitlements that need to be fixed. And so when you say to people, you will read in the wonk world, and you'll read in Politico, you know, well, people are floating the idea of raising the retirement age on Medicare. This is one of those things. The Republicans are saying, no, it's not enough to sort of whittle around the edges. We need changes in eligibility. That's their kind of, that's the red line they've thrown out. Now, go ask the American people who have just been through an election, how do you feel about raising the retirement age on Medicare? And this is what they tell you.
Now, I should say that eligibility comment, this is, I think, Hayes also baiting people's, because he says Republicans are arguing for changes in eligibility, that raising the age, in other words.
71% of Democrats oppose, 68% of Republicans oppose, and 62% of independents oppose. It's very hard to find a less popular, proposal than this. And yet, this is at the not even in the margins, at the center of the conversation when people start talking about a grand bargain. And Sam, you were elucidating a kind of argument for why that was right when we went to break.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the establishment in this country, whether it's the political or the media establishment in this country.
The worst.
They don't have the sensitivity towards this. I mean, when you talk about raising the eligibility for Medicare age, you're talking about privatizing it. You know, the costs aren't going to go away. It's just simply you're going to say instead of support,
for those 2 years, right?
Instead of support for our seniors, well, we're going to force these seniors, who in many cases may not be able to afford it, or their kids to pay for it. So this idea that somehow this is, you know, we're burdening our grandkids by not cutting Medicare, well, that's ridiculous.
Right.
Now, I should say what I'm doing there is very consciously taking what I anticipate people's talking point is going to be. Based upon our conversations at the break and how annoyed he was with me, I just had the sense that all of a sudden I realized this guy is a no-labels guy. This is a guy who is basically just a Pete Peterson guy. And this is always the talking point, right? We're burdening our grandkids by actually having the government in some way provide the most efficient health insurance for the grandparents.
Because those grandkids are going to pay for it, and they're actually going to pay more
right.
in the private insurance industry than they would through Medicare. And that's just
enough.
The fact. And so, and I'm talking about those grandkids literally. They don't
right.
They're going to be paying for their grandparents or their parents to get health insurance on those ages if you raise it. So the savings is not going to, it's simply going to, we're going to push it on to individuals, we're going to push it on to the other generations, and we're going to make it cost more because we know that Medicare controls costs more and is delivered more efficiently.
I agree with him, actually, that because the next step of that, of course, is that the kids and the grandkids will be burdened with it, and that's a greater drain on the economy because it takes
right.
their money and spending power out of the economy and puts it into health care. However, though, I do think there should be some further adjustments on eligibility. For example, someone like me, I do not believe
right.
that I should be able to get the same kind of benefits as, say, a retired school teacher.
Right.
And so, therefore, I should have to pay a greater copay. The threshold before I got any benefits should be there. Now, also, my children, hopefully, if they are successful, I think we have a responsibility to take care of our parents, too,
right.
if we can. The government needs to be helping people who can't help themselves, that are going to have difficulty doing
and this,
that.
And I'm glad you made this argument, because this is the argument that you hear Pete Peterson make, who's a big, sort of funding a lot of the groups that are talking about attacking the debt or the deficit. And you hear Mitch McConnell, but you hear Republicans make it, and you hear some Democrats make it, which is basically, well, look, progressives, you guys care about redistribution, and you care about all these things, equality, and that's good. Why have these universal benefits when we don't have enough money? Why have universal benefits for people that have a lot of money? I mean, that's the argument, right?
Indexing it.
Right, yeah. Indexing it, right? But making it a more an adjusted kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Means testing.
Okay, so there you have what Hayes has done is basically brought out what the essence of Peeble's argument is. Peeble is shrouding this. First, he says, well, someone as rich as me, shouldn't basically should have to pay more for my health insurance. And in fact, someone as rich as my kids should also pay for my health insurance if I can't afford it. So basically what he's saying is that this idea of universal access to health insurance for all seniors and ostensibly all people is problematic to this guy. He wants to see health insurance provided only as welfare. He wants to see it only as Medicaid, even though we also know that some 80% of people, regardless of what their income was when they were younger, end up in nursing homes or do so on Medicaid. He wants to make sure that there is no right, affirmative right, to health insurance in this country. That's what his agenda is. And then Hayes basically calls him out and says, yeah, you and Pete Peterson. And so I come back with this, basically saying that there's a very efficient way of providing for means testing. And it's this.
Well, first off, Medicare is already means tested.
Yes,
you
is.
Already do have right. some measure of that. And if you want to means test it more, there's a very efficient way of doing that, a far more efficient way than to have a new bureaucracy that's going to determine what your net worth is, and that's called taxation.
Right.
And so we take it to you from you on the front end.
Right.
And then, frankly, that's what we should be doing with Social Security. We should be obliterating the cap. We can be raising taxes.
When you say obliterating cap, explain what that means.
Well, the cap right now, the first $110,000 of Social Security wages are taxed at about 6% for the employee, at 6% for the employer, a little bit more, 6.5%. And traditionally, we have taken in, through the Social Security system, 90% of the nation's income. We're now about 81% because of income inequality.
Right.
If we take off that cap, we have complete solvency in Social
right.
Security, not just 20 years out, but until my kid has a kid who is looking towards Social Security. And we can do the same thing with Medicare.
Your kid is 40 years old, though. We should
my
say.
Kid is actually significantly older than
that. Just so that everyone knows what you're saying.
I have a 7-year-old, and to the eye can see. And we can do the same thing with Medicare. If you're really concerned about means testing, there's an easy way.
That's interesting. So your point is, don't do it on the benefit side of means test. Just make sure that we're taxing.
Just have people put more money into the system.
What do you think of that, Richard?
Right. I agree with, you know, I think that the cap is, it creates this regressive pattern, you know,
right.
I think it's a long-term, it's the long-term solution on Social Security, but I don't think Social Security needs to be on the table.
Yeah, and it doesn't
when
seem
we
like
talk about,
I think
yeah.
we all agree.
Now, that was Arenberg, Richard Arenberg, basically saying that he agrees with that about the Social Security. And the dynamic on Medicare is exactly the same. But now, Peoples has to push back against this notion of, wait a second, my argument to means test. Now, the means testing, he doesn't care about the means testing. Because we all know that means testing, first off, saves you virtually no money. If every millionaire had to pay, and we already have some means testing in the context of Medicare and some parts of the insurance, but I mean, if you were to provide the means testing he's talking about, we're talking about such a small number of people, unless it became an incredibly a complicated system. But even still, you're talking about virtually no savings. Virtually no savings. So this is not really about means testing. This is about making Medicare into a welfare program, because it is far easier to cut a program that is not providing universal access, that is not for everybody. And that's his real agenda.
I think Medicare right. is being discussed.
And same dynamic.
But again, right. I don't think that we can ask the American people, especially job generators at the top end, to pay.
Wait, what? Job generators at the top end? We can't ask them what?
More in taxes other than what's being discussed.
Well,
now.
You're saying
you want
job generators
interest,
to pay
think,
more for their health insurance.
Absolutely. At the
so
time
all
of
I'm
consumption.
Saying is, let's
at
the do top, it the most.
Give it to you in the front end and trust you to spend it well now.
Yeah.
Or trust the government to spend it well now.
Well, yeah, I trust
and
the government
it'll be
to
there.
Now, he wants to do it at the time of consumption. So we have to create this whole bureaucracy that is not going to be efficient to determine whether or not this guy deserves insurance year to year, right? Because he could lose his money. He could lose all his money. That's his argument. It's going to be his argument shortly. They could lose all their money. So we're going to have to do this year to year to qualify, as opposed to making it nice and simple. Raise a little bit on his wage taxes. Raise a little bit on his income taxes. But we can't have that for job generators, because we all know that even despite the fact that Mitt Romney won't hire a guy to make his peanut butter and honey sandwiches, that if you take away any taxes from these job generators, they're not going to hire people. We've asked so much of them.
Spend things as well as anybody else, frankly. And
well,
so,
that's
I
a
mean,
frightening thought there. Okay.
Well, but, he doesn't like government spending.
Wait a second, though. Right. When we're talking about this, I mean, we could talk about, we should just be very clear, right, about how this actually all works, right? There are, Social Security and Medicare have dedicated tax revenue streams, right? Yes. So when you're talking about
some
the front
of Medicare
end,
comes from the general fund.
Some of it comes from the general fund. But there's income taxes, then there's a bunch of other taxes in the tax code, and then there's these payroll taxes that you pay that are that create this distinct funding mechanism for these.
Now, so here Peebles doesn't like the idea of actually having to pay up front because, of course, like I say, it's much easier to cut the program if it's seen as a welfare program for poor people and rich people can opt out. Taxes are forever. And then finally, this is where it ends.
Get more to the political aspect of it. So
now, remember, this guy loves to switch between what is political reality and what is the best policy. When you start to argue policy with him, he says there's no political reality. He's trying to keep all of this at arm's length. That's what his plan is. And DeSoto, or DeFrancesco Soto, she's also looking at this in the same sort of fashion. It's interesting.
Maybe popularly people don't want to see Medicare touch. But the Beltway folks, the folks who are going to be voting on this, do want to see that. So what are we going to bring to the table? Are we just going to say...
Now, I'm going to start this over again because, I mean, think about what she's saying here. She's saying, okay, we've seen that Democrats and Republicans in the high 60s, Democrats in the low 70s, don't want any cuts to Medicare. But the people in Washington do. So what are we going to bring to the table? Who is we in her calculation? Is she now with those people who don't want cuts to Medicare? I mean, why do we have to bring anything to the table if there is no policy justification and no desire by the American public to cut Medicare? What? Why? Who is we, and why do we have to do anything? Let's play it again from the beginning.
Get more to the political aspect of it. So maybe popularly people don't want to see Medicare touch. But the Beltway folks, the folks who are going to be voting on this, do want to see that. So what are we going to bring to the table? Are we just going to say we're not going to bargain with you? I mean, at what level do we allow for, say, means testing? We may not like it, but that's
well,
what's
that's
going
my
to
point.
Allow.
Is, listen, means testing, we can do means testing. If you want to do means testing, there's a very efficient way of doing it. We will raise your taxes
right.
on
if you have more money.
If you have more money,
but the reality is that's not going
to
happen.
But wait a second. We can talk about what we projected.
But
here's the reason why that's not going to happen.
And cut defense spending 20% and put that into the general fund as well.
Okay, so what Peebles is doing here now is saying, but that's not going to happen. Your idea about taxing people more for Medicare is not going to happen. So now he's stepping back. He's no longer advocating a position. He's now just an observer again, right? That's not going to happen. And now, also to add a little bit of spice in there, he says, we could also cut the Defense Department by 20 or 30% and put it in the general fund. That's not going to happen either. In other words, he's looking at me and saying, I am now going to put you, your idea of raising taxes to pay for Medicare if there's any type of shortfall, into the realm of unicorns and fantasy land. That's what he's doing here with that.
Well, and we would be able to reduce a lot, hold everybody's taxes, but that's an action that's never going to take place.
Wait, so can I follow
reality,
with
what
this?
She's
wait,
talking about?
Hold on a second.
What she said is actually very valid. What's the fact is that there's going to have to be give and take. However, the president.
Okay, so then he says, well, what she's saying is actually valid. So what you're saying, Sam, is crazy talk. What she's saying is valid. There has to be some give and take here. Now, where is he in this debate? He's pretending like he's just an observer, but in fact, he's one of the key players pushing an outcome. But this is what the new no labels people do. This is what the Pete Petersons do. This is what the Joe Scarboroughs do. This is what the establishment does. They step back from the debate and say there has to be, they set up a context where they know a negotiation is going to lead them to their end. And then they step back and say, we have to all get along. Regardless of how crazy we think the dynamic is here, we just, that's just the dynamic. That's immutable. That can't change.
Has played a very powerful hand by saying, "Okay, tell us what you want."
But let me say this on the give and take.
There's a reason why we can sit here and say it's never going to happen, and it will never happen until people acknowledge the reality of the situation from a policy standpoint. You can say that the Republicans are never going to allow for a more efficient way of means testing, which is to raise taxes.
That's your
on
opinion.
That's not debatable.
You're not even going to get Democrats.
You're
to buy
talking
into
politically,
that.
Okay. But I mean, if you will,
well, is that can, reality?
Okay.
Okay.
In reality,
40%
if you join me right. in acknowledging yeah. the reality that the most efficient way of means testing Medicare would be to raise Medicare taxes now. That's a reality. Whether or not that's going to happen is another issue. But if you join me,
because,
we can join together.
Oh, wait, hold on a second. Think about it this way. We just had, we came off in the 2000s, early to mid-2000s, the biggest boom in the nation's history. Then we went to the second biggest recession in the nation's history. So wealth has been redistributed and lost. Right. Now imagine that concept that you just talked about, where these...
Now, first off, he's lying. Wealth was lost, but I don't know if he's saying that it's just been lost by the wealthy. It's been lost by everybody. And the notion that it's been redistributed is also questionable. He's talking about things like food stamps have gone up. He's talking about things like somehow we have unemployment insurance. But the fact of the matter is that income inequality has grown during this period. This guy has not suffered. But that's his argument. We have suffered. And here he's going to go to job generators again. Now, you saw what I was trying to do there. I was basically saying, okay, you want to have your reality is the politics? Well, then join me in admitting that the policy prescription is wrong. You wouldn't do that.
People are paid into it, and now they're in a different income position. That doesn't make sense. We should be taxed. This is any kind of means test should be done at the time of consumption. For example, if I can afford to pay my health care, I should pay for it.
I mean, if we really...
So there his argument is there are people who lost money, rich people. Okay, this is what he was just arguing, and it's absurd. He's saying that there were really rich people, maybe millionaires, maybe people who made over $500,000 a year, $700,000 a year, $1 million a year, whatever, who paid into the system under my regime that I'm proposing, would have paid into the system, whatever it is, an extra 10 grand a year, 25 grand a year, if they have the millions that he does, maybe half a million a year, maybe 200,000 a year, if he's making whatever, $20 million a year. I don't know, probably less. And then they lost all their money, and now they're on Medicare, and that's not fair. No, that's exactly why you have social insurance. That's exactly why you have social insurance. But that's his argument. Seems a little lame.
About the deficit and debt issues that we're talking about.
Yes, but the key thing here is, which is my mantra, is that no one actually cares about the deficit and debt.
That's the key thing. People talk about it because it's the word
they give to the stuff they really care about.
Right.
Richard Ehrenberg from the Strength and Social Security Campaign, Sam Cedar of the Majority Report, Don Peebles of the President's National Finance Committee, and MSNBC contributor Victoria De Francesco Soto. Thanks for being here. That was great.
Thank you.
And that's the end of it there. And so that was my I was rather excited. I felt bad because at one point I cut off Hayes and I couldn't contain myself. I think he understood. I mean, I think to a certain extent that's why he wanted me on there. There were times where off camera he was like, I think, egging me on. But that if you want to see, and I'm convinced this Peebles guy was just sort of shocked. Yeah, and believe me, he didn't seem too happy with me afterwards. I went up and I, you know, shook his hand because for me that was a tremendous amount of fun. I don't get the opportunity to basically tell a plutocrat, you're lying. to the country, or you're lying to yourself. But that is the mentality of these people. So when you see the Pete Petersons, and we should say, you know, yes, this guy, a big donor to, or big bundler, I should say, for President Obama in the 2010 cycle, 2008 cycle, I think he was also a bundler for Obama. I'm not sure, but he gave to Raul Martinez, a Democrat in Florida, Rudolph Moisey, another Democrat in Florida, the 17th and 21st. I don't know them. I do know who the Republican Party of Florida is. And back in 2000, he gave $5,000 to the Republican Party of Florida. So, I mean, this gives you just, this is a species of Democrat that exists out there. This is a plutocrat. There is no other better way to describe them. And we had real insight into the way that they argue and how you get from being a plutocrat to the no labels or third way movement. That is to pretend the influence of your money has not changed the political dynamic, and then step back and say, this is the political dynamic. Let's just be reasonable here and try and get along. Some people, for whatever reason, we don't need to discuss the merits, don't want an estate tax. Some other people, I'm going to pretend that I'm one of those people until I'm cornered, do think there should be an estate tax. And we can't have it because, of course, there were 8 members of the Congressional Black Caucus back in 2003 that supported getting rid of the estate tax. So this is a civil rights issue. And I'm sure if this guy was a white guy, he would have some other argument. We're keeping out new money from growing, whatever it is. So it was a stunning insight. Wanted to share it with you. Went a little long. We're going to take a break, go to the better half of the program. We'll do a little extra today. Remember, if you have the opportunity to support this program, please do. It supports my hobby of going on to MSNBC on the weekends and arguing with plutocrats. Although, it just rarely happens. I've had a couple of good moments like that. But all right, folks, I'm going to take a break. When we come back, 646-257-3920, I will take your IMs. I've got a bunch of them loaded up. We'll be right back in just a moment.